Hi, this is Richard Epstein at the University of Chicago. I'm going to talk today about two recent preemption decisions in the United States Supreme Court. The first of these is Regal against Medtronic, and it involves the question of whether or not FDA rules concerning medical devices preempt state law tort actions. The second of these cases is a case called Roe against the
New Hampshire Motor Transport Association.
And this has to do with the Motor Carrier Act of 1980, which provides that no state may enact or enforce a law that relates to the price, route, or service of any motor carrier. These preemption cases are, in fact, the latest in a long string of preemption cases, and it's probably useful at the outset just to review the way in which we ought to think about them. The question of preemption has gotten much greater importance since the 1937 Constitutional Revolution, because at that time, essentially, we adopted a system which says that federal power is plenary with respect to all matters of economic regulation, so that the federal government may, at its free will and pleasure, either displace the way in which the states operate on the one hand, or give them concurrent authority or exclusive authority over any particular issue. Since there now is no strong constitutional theory which gives states a certain degree of vested rights, everything seems to turn on the way in which various statutes are drafted to deal with the question of whether or not one of the many new federal initiatives is designed to displace in whole or in part that which takes place at the state level. And the initial presumption in these cases, in a case involving Santa Fe Company against Rice, was the so-called presumption against preemption, the purpose of which was to indicate that the federal government would not, in close cases, be construed to displace the states so that they could exercise their historic police powers. As regulation becomes more exhaustive and more comprehensive and more thorough, there is a certain tension between that 1946 or 47 presumption on the one hand and the modern schemes which seem to have much more of a womb-to-tomb characteristic. And that tension was very much manifest in the two cases that we have today, both of which by strong majorities held that the preemption was in fact done. Let's take them in order and see how they work. In Regal, the particular statute was the Medical Devices Act, under which the federal government, through the FDA, regulates the medical devices that are allowed to go into the market. And in effect, there are two forms of regulation that could take place. One of these is essentially a form of pre-market notification, in which all you have to do is to file certain papers with the FDA, after which you could market your product, but there's no sense in which the FDA has run any kind of comprehensive inspection. And several years ago, about 10 years ago, in a case called Medtronic against Lohr, it was held that there is no preemptive effect such that if these devices, which had only been notified but not approved by the FDA, were attacked in state law common actions, the actions could go forward. Situation changes very much when we start dealing with situations involving pre-market approval. As Justice Scalia noted in a strong opinion in the Supreme Court, pre-market approval is a big deal. It takes you 1,200 hours, for example, of time to get the device through. And once the device gets through the system, it turns out that the manufacturer cannot change it in any particular unless he goes back to the FDA in order to get some kind of a certification that that revision is going to be permissible. So the question then is, if a manufacturer is locked into a particular device, can a state court come along through its juries and say, oh, no, 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 the device that you happen to put forward is so dangerous that what we're going to do is to allow the state common law action on the grounds that the design is, in fact, quite defective. The circumstances under which it took place in the Regal case were, in fact, most unattractive for the plaintiff. This involved a special balloon catheter, which was used for doing various kinds of angioplasties, artery-clearing exercises near the heart. And it turned out that the physician in question, for good reasons or for bad, decided to use this particular balloon at pressures beyond which for which they had been approved. So, in effect, he was overinflating them, and it burst, and consequences were serious injuries. So you now have a situation in which if you allow a state common law jury to pass on this question, they can decide that the FDA decision was in fact wholly inappropriate. And Justice Scalia was quite right when he said, look, to the extent that the FDA has the power under these kinds of circumstances to basically prohibit any requirements in addition to or different from those which the FDA has done, you certainly don't want, on matters of health and safety, to allow the juries in a particular state to make a different trade-off between safety and effectiveness. And so he said this scheme was so basically comprehensive that anything that the state did would be inconsistent with the federal scheme, and he knocked down the action. And I confess a certain degree of mystery as to why it is that anyone would think that this is a particularly hard case. In general, as an intellectual matter, I think dual inconsistent schemes of enforcement are a bad thing, and since there are no independent Federalist grounds after 1937, it seems to me that the appropriate way to look at this particular case is to say quite simply, once the federal government has spoken, it has set not only a floor for what this device should look like, but a ceiling so that you cannot say that the safety that it provided was not sufficient. There was a lone dissent by Justice Ginsburg who said that there was no clear intention in this particular case to say, look, we don't want to make sure that consumers are left without remedies. My reaction to that is, if you really were to allow the tort remedy, consumers would be left without products because the risk of marketing would now become so great if any jury anywhere in the land could contradict what the exhaustive FDA surveys have done. The situation with respect to the Roe case is, I think, less dramatic and less important, but nonetheless rather interesting. Because when you start looking at the Motor Carrier Act, what it provides, in effect, is a state may not enact or enforce a law related to the price, route, or service of any motor carrier. And sure enough, when it comes to the regulation and distribution of tobacco products, the state of Maine had a better idea. And so what it did, in effect, is it required shippers to only hire those kinds of carriers who would engage in delivery only after they receive elaborate verification that the products were shipped to individuals who were eligible to receive them, and so therefore required various kinds of countersignatures and the like. These regulations were different from those which were required by normal delivery under contract and were different from anything which might have been required under federal law. And so if you start to look at this thing, you could take a very myopic view and say, since the obligation is only imposed upon the shippers rather than upon the common carriers, the preemption doesn't apply. But the risk of circumvention of a federal system by putting the liability on Mr. A, knowing that A is in fact going to impose the obligation on Miss B, is simply so great that what happened, in another strong opinion by Justice Breyer, is that he treated this elaborate system as tantamount to an imposition upon the carriers to provide these extra delivery services in the case of tobacco-related products, and the bottom line was that he held that they were also preempted by the federal statute. And once again, it seems to me that it's very difficult to think that there's much of a difficulty going on in these cases. And so essentially what we can say about both of these cases is that they seem to be easy by two kinds of tests. One, you have a fairly comprehensive scheme of federal regulation that seems to occupy the field. And secondly, it seems as though there's an actual kind of conflict between what it is that the federal statute mandates and what it is that the state is trying to do. I'm much more worried about the common law actions in a case like Riegel, because the huge damage verdicts have an ability to disrupt an entire industry, than I am worried about the additional delivery requirements that you have in a case like Roe. Ironically, there seems to be almost a reverse sentiment in some of these cases in the following way. There has always been a battle as to whether or not a state requirement covers only administrative ordinance or statute, or whether it also covers common law actions, which don't require you to do something under pain of injunction, but only award damages. Fortunately, the Supreme Court has said we're going to treat these things as though they're requirements so that the coercive effect cannot be ignored. And once that is done, the ability to control common law actions, since they are much more disruptive of any federal scheme than additional state schemes of regulation, seems to me a good thing. The question going forward is, in doubtful cases where there's some degree of ambiguity as to what the statute allows or prohibits, which way will the presumption go on preemption? And the latest sign that we have in these two particular cases is that the assertion of unitary federal authority is probably going to take over, but we can't be sure that this will continue because the problem here has been highly variable over the years, and who knows, another term, another case may lead to another change in direction. But that's the way life goes in the big city of Washington. This is Richard Epstein from the University of Chicago.